We explore the power of the prosecutor in the justice system and go behind the scenes on an investigative podcast series called Open and Shut from Wisconsin Watch and WPR. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The power of the prosecutor, look, it came to light again this week. Former Wauwatosa police officer Joseph Mensa won't be charged in the 2016 fatal shooting of Jay Anderson Jr. The court-appointed prosecutor said they would have trouble convincing a jury, not enough evidence to charge Mensa with a crime. Join in on DA's, this investigative reporting, your podcast takeaways, 800-642-1234. Dee Hall is co-founder and managing editor of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, also known as Wisconsin Watch, reporter on Open and Shut. Dee, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me again.
Good morning. How do you regard the power of prosecutors this week, considering the Joseph Mensa case outcome? How does not prosecuting a case illustrate the power held by prosecutors?
I think that's exactly it. I mean, you go from being an officer who is suspected of possibly committing a crime to a regular citizen. And so Joseph Mensa is no longer facing, you know, severe consequences, for example, being convicted and possibly spending time in prison. And that was simply that's in the hands of a single prosecutor when that happens. And so that is a really good illustration of the unilateral and, we have found, largely unchecked power of prosecutors in Wisconsin.
And these prosecutors, they had relied heavily on the footage and, you know, the dash cam footage and these still images and to come to their conclusion. And the family really expressed frustration that they didn't know why they didn't consider more other evidence or witnesses brought forward in hearings. And from your reporting, how do prosecutors use evidence?
Well, I mean, our series actually focused on how they misused it, withheld it. In one case, we featured Joseph Fry. The physical evidence was destroyed before he even went to trial, which, of course, made it very difficult for him to prove his innocence, which he later did. Yes, I mean, the thing about prosecutors is they are free to examine and accept evidence or reject it if it doesn't seem to fit their theory of the crime. So Joseph Fry is a perfect example of that. There was evidence that excluded him from DNA samples taken from a sexual assault victim from a scene, and they disregarded those. They simply kept prosecuting him for a sexual assault, even though the DNA results, which are sort of the gold standard of evidence, excluded him. So that shows a big piece of the discretion that prosecutors have. Not only do they are they able to weigh the evidence in whichever way they choose to do it, but as in some of these cases we found, the prosecution also hid that evidence from the defense, making it very difficult for people who are suspected of crimes to defend themselves.
You shed light on how former Outagamie County District Attorney Vince Biskupic secured guilty pleas and won convictions. Why are some people critical of how he has done his job?
Well, what we found was a series of actions that were taken that appeared to, for example, violate the Brady Rule. The Brady Rule is established in case law that the prosecutor shall turn over all evidence that could point to the innocence of an accused. Mm. We found multiple cases in which that did not happen, key pieces of evidence that were either withheld or in the case or for some reason were not available, were destroyed prior, so that the defendant was not able to use them to try to prove his innocence.
And then, as a judge, Biskupic has held these review hearings to monitor defendants' behavior or to, you know, prompt them to pay fines. What impact has that had?
Well, it was kind of a self-styled program that the judge appeared to be running. He, based on some correspondence that he sent to us, it appears maybe he is not holding these review hearings anymore, but they're not specifically called for in state law. He used a variety of techniques to It looked like sort of offer a deal or offer a break to defendants. But once they got into these relationships where their sentence was withheld and then they had to come back to the court over and over to give like a report to the judge, to Judge Muskupic, about how they were doing, whether they had gotten a job, how they're doing on getting a GED, a high school equivalency degree. And what defense attorneys that we talked to found is that these arrangements could become sort of unending. There was no end date, unlike a sentence where you say, okay, you're going to be in jail from this time to this time. These went on for months and sometimes years.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment, talking with Dee Hall, co-founder and managing editor of Wisconsin Watch, co-creator and primary contributor to the new podcast, Open and Shut. Have you been listening to it? Join in with your reaction, your takeaways, your questions about the work of prosecutors. 800-642-1234. Your podcast presented several cases overseen by Biskupic to Pace University law professor Bennett Gershman. And after reviewing those cases, Gershman told you he was surprised that Biskupic was never formally charged with misconduct. Let's listen.
I think it's a disgrace that the courts and the disciplinary bodies in your state of Wisconsin took no action against this prosecutor. There were no consequences visited upon this prosecutor. I think it's a disgrace.
You can hear the emotion in his voice.
Yes.
What did you hear from those outside people who are looking at what was going on here in Wisconsin?
Well, Professor Gershman was particularly passionate. He literally wrote the book on prosecutorial misconduct, and the title of the book is Prosecutorial Misconduct. And so he is a national expert on this issue. And what he told us was that the types of alleged activity on the part of Mr. Biskupic as a district attorney were the types and the volume of questionable actions that he would have expected in 20 prosecutors, not one.
Wow.
And so he talked about these were repeated issues, for example, withholding evidence, for example, using witnesses who had received an incentive, but was that incentive was not revealed to the defense. So he was quite critical of the cases that we brought to him and the ones that we featured in the podcast.
Let's bring on a caller now. Andrew joining us from Dousman. Andrew, hi, go ahead.
There, I just
Oh, Andrew, you've got a bad reception. Try again. Oh, I think we've got some bad reception there. But I think Andrew wanted to point out in regards to prosecutors picking and choosing evidence, Andrew said, in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, and what evidence was shown by lawyers there, the video different from their own. And I'm wondering, and I probably am not quite piecing this together correctly, but what can we learn, Dee, from the Rittenhouse case and how prosecutors proceeded there?
And I'm having to rack my brain to remember what the disputes were about the evidence there. I mean, when you look at, we at Wisconsin Watch, we did some stories back right around the time of the incident in which Kyle Rittenhouse admitted and was seen on tape shooting to death two people there at some protests. The question in that case was, did he fear for his life? And so was this a self-defense case? And those are, excuse me, those are tricky because he could argue that he, although he had a semi-automatic rifle or he had a long gun there of some type, that this man with a skateboard was about to hit him right in the head and that he was afraid. And so that's why he shot him. And so that was, and I don't recall which evidence was used or excluded. A lot of times you have a dispute over what evidence means from the part of the defense and the prosecution. You know, for example, people can make a statement and perhaps the police read it as being, oh, that person's admitting to it. And then, you know, a defense attorney might say, well, that person wasn't admitting to that at all. In fact, they were, what they said was this, what they meant was this.
Wisconsin Watch Managing Editor Dee Hall with us behind the new podcast series Open and Shut. Join in on local prosecutors from your perspective as an attorney or working in the justice system. Reaction to the podcast now. All episodes have dropped. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dee Hall here on the Ideas Network. We take an inside look on the podcast series Open and Shut as all episodes are now out. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Prosecutors, as we've been talking about, wield a lot of power in the justice system. And with so much power concentrated on just one side of a criminal case, their decisions can have a huge impact on the accused. And this investigative series was years in the making. It's from Wisconsin Watch and WPR. Dee Hall is behind the investigative reporting as managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. Join in on your reaction to Open and Shut, questions you have about prosecuting crime in Wisconsin, the effect on incarceration. 800-642-1234. Dee is with us for about nine more minutes. You know, Dee, I don't want to hold this out till the end, but what are some solutions? What are some big ideas you heard along the way about ways to reform the power of the prosecutor?
Well, one of the ideas that we heard from one of the experts we talked to was requiring more transparency on the part of the prosecutor when it comes to evidence. There was a case in Texas in which a man spent, I believe it was over 20 years in prison for allegedly murdering his wife. And it was actually, and he'd always said he was innocent. The prosecution had withheld some key evidence that would have pointed to the actual perpetrator who was later. So this particular man, Mr. Morton, was exonerated. Someone else was charged with a crime, was linked to the crime. And then state lawmakers decided, you know what, we need to make it mandatory under the law that prosecutors turn over basically not the evidence that they pick through and decide they want to share, but all of the evidence before the case gets to the point where they might, for example, reach a plea deal with a defendant. Because that was one of the things we looked at, was the power of the prosecutor to reach plea deals. And people who are guilty will sometimes, will sometimes plead guilty to get a, quote, better deal because they are afraid of spending longer in prison. One of the cases we highlighted, Mark Price, he did exactly that. He knew that he had not put out a, quote, unquote, hit on former Winnebago County District Attorney Joe Paulus, but he wasn't sure that he could prove that he didn't. Because the prosecutor was saying, we have all this evidence. And so he was offered a deal whereby he would get a lot less time in prison if he just pled guilty to some of these charges. And so the problem with these plea arrangements, which is how more than 90% of all cases in America are resolved, is that in cases in which the defendant does not have a full picture of the evidence, they may end up pleading guilty to a crime they didn't do or pleading guilty to a more serious crime than the one they actually committed.
This plea brokering is so widespread. That to me is really surprising because that's not how the justice system should work.
And that's exactly how it does work. And you know, anytime there's a trial, that is the exception, not the rule.
Let's take another call. William in Whitehall, a former prosecutor. Hi, William. Go ahead.
Thank you. I think this is a very important topic, but I think it's also one that requires careful study. As the speaker has alluded to, there is a constitutional requirement to disclose exculpatory evidence. Most district attorneys' offices, and I was an assistant district attorney for nearly 37 years, would tell you they're so overworked and have so many cases on their desk. They do everything they can to make sure that evidence is disclosed because they know that if they don't, it's going to come back to haunt them. I think we can always find outlying cases where either terrible mistakes or bad conduct has occurred. But before any sweeping changes occur in the system, I think this has to be very carefully studied. I've seen a lot of articles in the last several years bemoaning the power of prosecutors. Well, someone has to make these decisions. There's always going to have to be discretion in the system. I was kind of bemused that one of the things you were talking about was a judge who had, it sounded like, a deferred prosecution system that maybe went off the rails. Well, that's not the prosecutor running that. I think that that prosecutors, yes, they have tremendous discretion. They have to, in order to deal with confused facts and to root out and find out what really happened and offer it. The duty of a prosecutor is not to get convictions. It's to do justice.
William, thank you. And I just want to pause here on what you're bringing to the table. Dee, go ahead.
So William brings up a really good point, and it's why we focused on these particular cases, is because they are not the norm. They show what happens when you push the envelope as far as it can be pushed and maybe beyond where it should be pushed, that most prosecutors do turn over the evidence they're supposed to because they understand it's their obligation. In terms of the mentioning the deferred prosecution type, the review hearings that Judge Biskupic did, that was focusing on him when he became a judge. So we were very aware that it was not the prosecution at all that arranged for these review hearings once Mr. Biskupic became Judge Biskupic. But I do think that, he brings up another really good point. They do have to have a lot of discretion because every case is different. There are cases where clearly a person, something happened, something bad happened, but there was no intention by the person who has been, suspected of a crime. It's a terrible accident, for example. And you want them to have great discretion. The question is, how much check do we have? What checks and balances do we have on that discretion? And what we found was that, in terms of when it comes to prosecutors, they have broad immunity to carry out their jobs, even when they do it badly. And so that's really the point of this, is that these were exceptional. These were not routine cases. And that's why I think Professor Gershman was so passionate, because he saw how far out of the mainstream the activity was in some of the cases that we highlighted in Open and Shut.
Did you also find workload, the volume of cases can be an issue here?
Well, we didn't highlight that in this podcast, but as a reporter, that has been a constant issue among prosecutors, is that they feel like they have so many cases to handle. That's one of the big incentives to have such a robust plea bargaining system, as, a trial takes many, many, many times more time than simply sitting down with a defense attorney, a defendant, and the prosecutor and saying, okay, what's a fair resolution to this? And that's much easier, much more expedient. But the problem with those is that sometimes it's not the right result and it isn't justice. But those are more of the rare cases. Most people who are charged are almost certainly guilty.
What did you learn from doing this podcast series?
Well, what I was hoping to do with the podcast series, and Phoebe, I don't know if we mentioned Phoebe Petrovic, she is the one who deserves all of the credit. She took some reporting I did many years ago and updated it and then got all kinds of new reporting to really shed light on these cases. But some of these, one of my goals with the podcast was to basically help people understand some things that I had come to know as a longtime reporter in the state, often covering criminal justice and wrongful convictions. And so basically, I don't know if I personally learned a lot, but I'm hoping that the listeners learned a lot about the history of prosecution in Wisconsin and the vast discretion that prosecutors have, and the importance of paying attention to that, because these are elected officials. These are people who we put in office, and our plea at the end, or Phoebe's plea at the end, is please pay attention to your local prosecutor and make sure that that person is in fact, bringing justice in the cases that he or she prosecutes.
Dee, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Dee Hall, co-founder and managing editor of Wisconsin Watch, co-creator and contributor to the new podcast, Open and Shut. Ahead this hour, we talk with a chef from Afghanistan who won an award for her dish, which was served to Afghan refugee patients. Join in on Culinary Aware Hospital Food. News is next on the Ideas Network. Hi, it's Kate Archer-Kent with The Morning Show. And as we talked about the podcast series Open and Shut, I want to direct your attention to Mapped Out. WPR has just released the final bonus episode of Mapped Out. It is the award-winning podcast that helps you understand redistricting and how it affects you. Listen at WPR.org/mappedout or wherever you get your podcasts. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about waterfalls.
Wisconsin is home to many spectacular waterfalls. And as exploring the state's natural wonders has grown in popularity, one Wisconsin listener wondered why the northern part of the state seems to have a monopoly on those waterfalls. WPR's Andrea Anderson takes you up north to find out more about the waterfall's geology and appeal.
Tom Hornung from Madison was entering a tourism-related drawing, and in order to win, he had to ask a question. After that, he came to Wisconsin with that very question. He wanted to learn why northern Wisconsin has more waterfalls than the southern part of the state. University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire hydrogeologist Dr. Sarah Vitale says most Wisconsin waterfalls are up north because there's a higher elevation. Plus, the tough igneous and metamorphic rocks in waterways with waterfalls aren't prone to erosion.
Where you have the steeper slopes that are maintained by those harder rocks, you're more likely to get waterfalls.
Vitale says the land elevation in northern Wisconsin is often more than 1,500 feet above sea level. That's about twice the elevation of much of southern Wisconsin, which sits 600 to 800 feet above sea level. Our question asker Tom from Madison speculates the impact of the Ice Age tens of thousands of years ago may have helped form northern waterfalls in Wisconsin. But Vitale says the Ice Age did not have as much of an impact as you might think.
Glaciation did a lot in terms of, seeing off what was at Earth's surface. And so any place you have a lot of glacial deposits, that's going to be easily eroded.
Southern Wisconsin does have waterfalls, including several in and around Devil's Lake State Park near Baraboo. But the vast majority are in state parks or county lands in far northern Wisconsin. A 2021 report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum says outdoor activities in Wisconsin flourished during the first year of the pandemic, including visitors to state parks. That includes Pattison State Park near Superior. That's where you'll find this waterfall. Big Manitou Falls, which is 165 feet high. It's the tallest waterfall in Wisconsin and one of the tallest in the upper Midwest. On the other side of Wisconsin is the state's most northeastern county of Marinette. It bills itself as Wisconsin's waterfall capital, boasting 16 waterfalls on public lands. Last summer, the Four Seasons Island Resort of Pembine became the first business to offer guided public tours of all the Marinette County waterfalls.
You can go to all of these for free on your own. Coming along on a trip with me, obviously I know all the roads and the routes to get to them, and I know the times of the year when the waterfalls are going to probably have a little bit more water on them and which ones you're really going to want to see.
Tour guide Steve Verdigan says last summer, dozens of people paid $65 each for a four-hour tour of many of the waterfalls and a lunch. Visiting the waterfalls also offers a chance to go bird watching or spot a white-tailed deer or black bear.
All the different berries that pop up in the wildlife that you get to see on this trip as well. The tour that someone gets at the end of May to the tour that I give in August or September are two completely different tours.
Marinette County also has more than 300 miles of ATV trails, and many of the trails have access to the waterfalls.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story. It was produced by WPR's John Davis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to a delicious award-winning vegetarian recipe for vegetable korma and a hospital chef who helped patients become nourished with a taste of home. Shakiba Samadzada is a chef with UW Health in Madison, and her recipe won the grand prize for the Healthcare Culinary Contest in an effort to reimagine hospital food. Shakiba put this on her menu last year as a way to help support pediatric Afghan refugees coming from Fort McCoy. Join in on korma, other dishes from Afghanistan you've tried, how to make naan, 800-642-1234. Shakiba, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. So tell us about your vegetable korma and what makes it special.
It makes it special because that's my mom's recipe. When I was really young and my mom taught me how to make the veggie korma, and it's like, it's healthy, it's a fresh vegetable and all kind of different veggies and the spices, like, it's amazing.
I would imagine you have really special memories of being alongside your mom and making this.
Yes. Actually, I was really young when my mom taught me how to make this veggie korma. I mean, she taught me a lot of more dishes too, but this one is like one of the special ones, and I love vegetable.
Mm. How have you made this dish for patients? Can you tell us a little bit of that backstory?
My supervisor, Dan, asked me, there's a refugee from Afghanistan, a patient is here in the hospital, if I can make some traditional Afghan food. And that's what I thought, like, the veggie korma would be the best because, you know, some of them doesn't eat meat or, you know, like, that's why I made the veggie korma. And it's like a very good dish. It's a lot of vegetable. It's a lot of good flavor. It has a lot of spice on it. Like, you know, like this turmeric, garlic, coriander, cumin. It's very, a lot of good flavor on it.
Hmm.
And it's come with a basmati rice inside of naan. And it's gluten-free. It's dairy-free. Everybody can have it.
Have you tried it out in the cafeteria?
I did actually when I made it for the patient first, and then we tried it in the cafeteria to see how the, you know, the customer or the employees or the visitor would like it. When they try it, like, we did it one time just for the sample, and then everybody's like, "Oh, when are we gonna have this dishes again? When are you gonna have this again?" And I talked to my supervisor, and we made it. It just went to the top. People love it. All the employees, doctors, nurses, everybody loves it.
So has it kind of become part of the menu, if you will, for what you make? Is it a more regular item now?
Yes, I make it once a month. We make it once a month. It's Monday. It's coming up this Monday. We're going to make it again. Yes.
I love that. I think your mom would love that too.
Oh, yes. You know, every time I make that dish and just think about her, like how she taught me how to make it, you know.
You know, Shakiba, being in a hospital is a stressful time. How can food help make it a little less stressful? How can food make it better?
I love cooking, actually. My passion is cooking. It is a stress working in a hospital, but it's just when you make a patient happy, like if your meal make it happy, it just, you know, it just warm your heart. You know, like it's make me happy when it's whoever eat my meal and they enjoy it, you know, food bring like, you know, friends, family, you know, at least like something they can forget about like a second or two, you know, eating that delicious food.
Yes, I would imagine that's what you think about when you make it. I want to walk through the vegetable korma, and we have a link to the recipe at our website, wpr.org/mornings. But can you kind of give us some tips as to how you put the korma together?
Okay. First is we cook it either like you put some either like a veggie oil or like olive oil. I make it with the olive oil here. Mm-hmm. The olive oil and is a sauteed onion. And then on the sauteed onion, you put like fresh garlic, turmeric, paprika, cumin, coriander, little cayenne pepper, and you saute the whole thing first to get the flavor with the onion, with the spices. Then you put fresh tomato, then some tomato paste, and then hot water, boiled a little bit. Then you add like the stuff of the veggies first, or whatever veggie you want to add. You know, sometimes, you know, potato cook faster, or green beans is literally, you know, like it's just a step by the step. You cook all of them together. And the last minute, you put like the garbanzo beans and the fresh cilantro chop.
Mm. And then you serve it over a bed of basmati rice?
Yes, we serve it with the white basmati rice and then a piece of naan.
How do you make sure that the veggies don't get too soft, a little bit too stewy maybe? You don't want to cook it down too much, I would imagine.
Oh, no, like it just like it depends what vegetable you put. Like, you know, like be a cook for like 32 years. You have like, you know, get a lot of more experience about the vegetable and how to make it. First, when I do all the saute, the vegetable, the onion with the spices, and then I put the green beans first, then the potato. Like I cook the green beans 5 minutes. Then I put the potatoes, cook with the green beans, another like 10 minutes. Then I put like the mixed peppers.
Okay. So you are gradually adding the vegetables based on how long they take to cook.
Yes.
Okay. So I buy my naan from the grocery store. I mm-hmm. have not successfully made it. Can we make naan at home and still get that really nice, soft, you know, that really wonderful texture?
Yeah, you do actually. The naan is not really hard to make. It's just really basic. It's warm water, yeast, salt, and flour. That's it. You mm-hmm. mix all together and let it raise for like maybe like a 45 minutes and then start making it like in 350, the oven for like, I would say 25 to 30 minutes. Just, you know, that's it.
That's it. That you make it yeah. sound easy.
I guess I have a lot of experience in the cooking, I should say. But it is easy. It is easy. It's not that hard. It's just like a simple 3-4 things.
We're talking with Chef Shakiba Samadzada, sharing her approach to making hospital food, how she thinks about nourishing patients, the families that move through the cafeteria. Join in with your reflections on hospital menus and dishes, acknowledging a larger world of tastes and culture. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with UW Health Chef Shakiba Samadzada as we explore her vision of hospital food and nourishing recipes Her award-winning recipe for vegetable korma will be acknowledged at the Culinary Institute of America's Menus of Change Leadership Summit set for later this month. We have a link to the recipe at WPR.org/mornings. Join in on the flavors from the heart of South Central Asia on Hospital Cuisine Worldly Dishes, 800-642-1234. And Chef Shakiba Samadzada with us for about 9 more minutes. So you were born in Afghanistan and immigrated to the United States in your late teens. Can you tell us about what led you to Madison?
I born in Afghanistan. I don't remember how old I was. We refugee from Afghanistan to Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in Pakistan for at least 10 to 13 years. I don't remember it exactly. Then I refugee to United States in Madison. I used to be married. My husband was here. That's the reason I came to Madison.
Okay. So what are your thoughts on Afghan refugees today as they navigate, you know, trying to resettle, trying to find a piece of home in a very different place?
It will be hard from the beginning. I mean, it's a new country, new place, new people, you know, the food and everything is new, but you get used to it. It was hard for me in the beginning too. Mm. I mean, now pretty much this is my own home. When I go back home and, you know, I get missed here. It's a good place to be, you know, live in. At least you have a freedom to do whatever you want in here. And that's the reason I made them that food, to make them comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, how did you get into cooking as a profession?
When I came the first time in Madison, I started working at the Kabul restaurant on State Street. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yes, I do. Uh-huh.
Yes. I worked for Kabul restaurant for 17 years. I started as a dishwasher.
Oh.
Yes, I started as a dishwasher. Then I was doing like washing dishes at the age of like, I think I was like 19 that time. It was kind of hard. And when I looked at the cook, I was like, oh, they do a lot of like clean job. And I started moving slowly to help the cook.
Hmm.
And then I started with that, you know, slowly from the dishes to help the cook and become as the cook.
Wow. What, what's one thing you can't do without in your cooking? Is there some type of tool in your kitchen or something that you really rely on in your cooking that you can't do without?
I would say my knife and a big cutting board. There's two things.
I bet that knife is very sharp.
It is. I love to work with a big knife and a big, nice cutting board. When I go to like, you know, my aunt's house and she has like, you know, small cutting board with a small knife, I'm like, oh, you know, that's one thing I don't think I can do better job if I'm in any different kitchen.
Uh-huh.
But that's one thing actually I should say.
Shakiba, if someone makes your vegetable korma and they say, oh, I love it. I love it. This is fabulous. My family loves it. What should they try next? Do you have suggestions for the next dish that they should try after the korma?
We have so many different delicious Afghan food and good flavor, and it's a healthy and it's a full of like, you know, delicious flavor on it. They can do exactly the veggie korma. Like if they want it with the meat, they can saute that vegetable, the onion with the spices. If they want to cook it with the chicken, they saute the chicken with the onion mm-hmm. and the spices first for at least for like a 10, 15 minutes. Then add the rest of the stuff on it. They can do the same thing with the chicken.
And so because, you know, some people might taste your vegetable korma and say, I can't believe there isn't meat in this, but you can actually add meat and make it, I would imagine, just adding more protein to it.
Oh, yes, they can. Yeah, they can do that. Yes, you can add a chicken, you can add a beef, or you can add a lamb. I grew up with like more like a lamb. They can do anything you can put it in, but it's just like eyeball, like what are you cooking first? You know, like chicken, take a little longer, then you add the rest of the vegetable.
We're talking with Shakiba Samadzada, who is a chef with UW Health in Madison, talking about our cooking for patients, and bringing a taste of home to it. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Shakiba, you know, with your family members, what is your, like, signature dish? What is the dish that everyone loves you to bring or loves you to make?
Well, when we're having a padluck at work, They always want me to bring a lamb dish.
How do you prepare your lamb?
The lamb is I cook the lamb with the rice, the basmati rice. I saute the onion with the lamb, garlic and turmeric, salt first. Then I add water on it. I cook it for like a half hour in a medium heat. Then I put the rice over it.
Mm.
Then add like a little bit more hot water and just cook it in this low heat for like 35 to 40 minutes.
It's interesting how you use salt in the cooking, because, you know, so often nutritionally we're trying to avoid salt. So how do you balance that out?
I mean, you don't put too much salt on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we use like a sea salt. You know, I use most of my dishes with sea salt, not regular salt. You can avoid the salt too. Just maybe like a little bit for the taste of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
pretty much. You don't have to put a lot of. I mean, I don't eat that much salt either. Mm-hmm. Just for like when you saute the meat with the onion and the seasoning. You can just put like a little, when I say salt, just a little bit salt, you know, mm-hmm. just like saute it, get the flavor for them, because you get the flavor from the onion and the other spices.
We only have a few seconds left, but I'm wondering, you know, you have to, with hospital food, cater to so many different tastes and cultures. How do you adjust and modify to make dishes that appeal to such a wide variety of tastes?
It's just like, it depends, you know, mm-hmm. depends like what they love and what they ask me to do. Like, you know, just,
you just try to modify as you go, I would imagine, and just adjust to what the patient needs. Well, Shakiba, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. You have a great weekend, everybody.
Oh, you take care. Shakiba Samadzada is a chef with UW Health in Madison. We have a link to her vegetable korma recipe at our website, wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.